Welcome to the Tangible Hope Podcast. My name is Willie Elliott. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan, and my co-host is Melinda Lewis, a professor of practice at the University of Kansas. Today we have Amy Castro, an associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the School of Social Policy and Practice. I gotta say, I like the name. And is the co-founder and faculty director of the Center for Guaranteed Income Research. She served as the co-PI of the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration under Mayor Michael Tubbs, which led to a proliferation of experimentation with unconditional cash across the U.S. She is co-PI of 30 applied cash transfer studies. Further, she currently advises more than 20 mayoral teams, state and county legislators, on unconditional cash research, to include Mayor Carter from St. Paul, who recently appeared on the Tangible Hope Podcast. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of an opener, and how you got into studying conditional cash transfers to solve poverty.
Yeah, I mean, good question. Sort of, you know, sometimes people ask, you know, why now? Why is all this experimentation happening with cash? And how did you end up here? You know, I would say if I were to sum up my involvement and interest in unconditional cash in a single word, it would be rage. I came of age as a researcher just before the fall of Lehman Brothers. That's when I was starting my PhD. And I'd practiced as a social worker for many years in family homelessness and working in community development all throughout the city of Philadelphia. And I watched systematically a generation of Black and brown homeowners be targeted by predatory lenders and just watched their wealth be wiped away. And as I sort of followed those trends and looked at the ways that we are seeing wealth just become completely unraveled, I mean, carefully built wealth that happened against all odds, I just felt as though, as a researcher, I'm just documenting the downfall of the market without thinking at all about interventions. And then when I looked, you know, to my colleagues, and I looked at our field to see, okay, what do we have to combat this level of poverty and this level of extreme economic stress? And the more I looked at the interventions that we had, the more I was convinced that none of them matched the scale of poverty and wealth loss that people were experiencing post-recession. At the same time, my co-PI, Dr. West, kept saying, you know, we should talk about universal basic income. I'm like, we can't talk about that. No one's ever going to take us seriously. Our career's going to tank. And we would finish these papers on the wealth gap and talking about foreclosure. And she's, you know, we need to talk about cash. She convinced me, you know, on that, and she was totally correct. And I really just hit this point where I thought, you know, I could build an entire career as a social welfare researcher, telling everybody how big and bad everything was, and I would be successful, right? You know what those metrics are. But at the end of the day, I felt like I had a responsibility as a social worker to actually try and do something instead of just documenting the downfall, which really led me to take a risk and start experimenting with cash. You know, we started the work that we did in Stockton in 2018, and we were one of only three places in the United States doing that work. And it was fairly risky at the time, and now it's something that's kind of happening all over the place. But to sum it up in brief, it was rage. It was, why are we don't have to accept the status quo. Why don't we try and think about things differently, from our methods to our interventions?
Well, I'm interested in, you know, as is often the case, when something gets some momentum, then folks grab onto that term and that idea, but without necessarily very much a consensus about what such an intervention looks like. Can you help the folks who are listening understand, what do you mean when you say guaranteed income? Are there particular elements of such an intervention that you think are essential? And if so, what are those? Because I would expect that some experimentation, some variability increases the likelihood that policymakers can snag onto it and say, yeah, this is ours, and that's a good thing. But there's got to be a core that you have to have this in order for it to have fidelity to what can demonstrate the kinds of outcomes that you're interested in as a researcher and a pursuer of justice to calm your rage and, you know, bring about the outcomes that you want for folks. What are those core pieces?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, first I should probably explain terms a little bit. So, you know, the term guaranteed income fits underneath this broader umbrella term in the literature called unconditional cash. And so unlike, you know, our traditional safety net, which is conditional, meaning you have to do a certain thing in order to receive benefits, unconditional cash functions exactly the way that it sounds. It's unconditional. There's no strings attached. You receive it simply because you're human. That's it. But then within that domain of unconditional cash, there's roughly three different buckets of terms. So the first is universal basic income, which means exactly what it sounds like. It's universal. It would apply to all residents of a city, a state, a county. We haven't had a true universal basic income tested at all in the United States. We've had things that are close. But key feature to a UBI or universal basic income is that the cash is recurring. It's predictable, and it's enough to cover your basic needs. You know, then the second form is basic income, which is the same thing, same logic. It just wouldn't apply to everybody universally. And then the third category is primarily what I study, which is guaranteed income, which is a little bit different. So guaranteed income shares that same feature of no strings attached, and it's recurring. And that's the most important thing. So we're not talking about a lump sum cash transfer or, you know, one, two, three payments. We're talking about recurring payments over time that you receive with no strings attached. And then, you know, within that space, there are really specific lines that, you know, our team and others draw around things like benefits interaction. So, you know, unlike some other proponents politically, we do not advocate for the elimination of the safety net in any way. Guaranteed income is designed to work alongside the safety net, not in place of it. And as far as how long the money should last, right, you know, how much money is required to create a certain amount of change, to us, the jury's still out. We're still in the middle of experimentation because exactly like you mentioned, you know, our role is making sure that policymakers have evidence to base policies on with unconditional cash rather than just ideology or ideas. But really that key feature, the key defining thing is that unlike the U.S. safety net, guaranteed income, UBI, basic income is designed to work unconditionally. You do not need to do anything. You don't have to perform for capitalism. You don't have to fit a certain set of behaviors that policymakers deem responsible. You simply, you know, you matter because you're human. Right. And that fundamentally is a completely different ethos than the amount of money that we get from wage labor.
I'm not asking you to choose a favorite. I'm sure that having a favorite guaranteed income pilot demonstration around the country would be like, you know, choosing a favorite child. But are there particularly promising parts of the country or thought leaders or pilots on the ground that folks who are listening who think, I also want people to have their needs met, whether or not they are fitting into certain gaps like that or certain slots in our capitalist structure. That is appealing to me, Dr. Castro. Where would they go and look at some of those promising places?
Yeah, I mean, there's such a wide range, and you're right, it would be like picking your favorite child. I mean, at this point in our center, there's around 20,000 people in treatment and control, and we're working all over the United States. So it really does vary. But I think when I think about sort of like where to look, I mean, the first resource I'd point people to would be the Stanford Basic Income Lab. They're our data visualization partners. So, you know, you can see spending data there from our projects, and you can also really see kind of a taxonomy of what these projects look like, which I think is really important. So reason being is we don't actually know yet how much cash is needed to create a specific amount of change based on cost of living, right? And so, you know, when we started out with Stockton, you know, we chose $500 a month in conjunction with our partners because it was kind of logical based on some things from economic mobility research. And most pilots since then have just done a kind of a copy paste of that, of saying, well, Stockton did 500, I'll do 500. And so when I think about places to look to as a model, I think about locations and people who are willing to say, I'm going to hold what we know about science, you know, around cash in one hand, but then I'm going to hold a deep rooted community knowledge in the other, and say, how do I need to adjust and tailor and tinker with either the amount of money or duration based on the community context, right? So, you know, innovative place I could think of right off the top of my head would be Newark, New Jersey. We haven't released data from Newark yet, but one of the things Newark did early on was say, hey, you know what? We don't know yet from research, what's better, a lump sum payment or a recurring payment? So why don't we test both? So they really, that mayoral team and that ground team had the foresight to say, hey, Penn, you're going to partner with us. Let's think about a way that we can garner public support on the one hand, but on the other hand, hold rigor, right? And so when I think about mayor of Newark, New Jersey, you know, Mayor Carter in St. Paul, the ways that these folks are leading is they're leading with science. And so it's, again, it's hard to pick a favorite. But when you think about places like that, I also think about Mayor Siddiqui in Cambridge, holding fast to community-based work while also holding fast to science is a really brilliant counter narrative to what's happening in the United States right now. And those are the places I would point people to.
The focus on cost, like how much, not cost mm-hmm. overall, but like what is the right amount, is something that we've also often been asked within asset building programs, mm-hmm. whether it be baby bonds, whether it be children's savings accounts or whatever. There are these always questions like how much is enough? And it really becomes a sticking point for some people. So, mm-hmm. And we don't know as of yet. Like, I always think of, it's not about what is the exact number, but what do they need to become the kind of people we think they need to become, right? To have the freedoms, to have the opportunities. What's mm-hmm. that about? What's the goal? Yeah. The goal for them to pay for college? Is it for them to do other things? Then you might say it differently. If it's to produce some effects, these indirect effects that we see kind of in the CSA field, you can get that from relatively small amounts of money, right? But if your goal is for them to pay for college, you got to put a lot more money in that kitty to be able to pay for college. And so a lot of it depends upon what the goals are. But we also did fall into a problem where when the account started off at $50, $25 initial deposits, or even $1,000 in the case of CEDOK, but those become very, you know, duplicated in many places in the magical numbers. And then it's taken us a lot of work to try to get them to understand that those were based upon funding. Those were based upon, they weren't based upon research. They weren't based upon what the people needed. Those were based upon just practical realities of trying to get the programs up and started. And I think baby bonds is seeing this some now. So typically baby bonds would say like a minimum $10,000 in an account, but in Connecticut, they put $3,000 in an account. They're mm-hmm. saying that's enough, right? And these things then become duplicated. And I fear for what they need long-term, right?
Yeah.
If we're really trying to solve certain kinds of problems, it's probably not the right amount. It's just the amount that they could do at the time.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a similar position with unconditional cash or guaranteed income, is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, what we've been doing over the past really 3 years is to say, how much money do we have for disbursements or the money directly going to people on the one hand? On the other hand, how much money do we then have for research, right? And reason being is not because we want to fund the research forever. I mean, when it comes down to research, you know, your salary is the same no matter what. It's just a question of the work that you're funded to do. And so what we wanted to do is really take a step back and say, is there a backdoor way at getting at exactly the question that you're asking? Because we're so limited by funding, and we've gotten pushback on this, and I think it's appropriate. People saying these experiments are really expensive. Like, how can you possibly justify millions of dollars on this when it hasn't been tested yet? So we really wanted to come up with kind of a clever way to say, how do we get at that sweet spot of figuring out what money creates what type of change based on population, knowing it's going to shift based on context? So one of the things that we did is that, you know, post-pandemic, as there was just a lot of momentum on cash kind of launching it right around the same time, as we said, let's think about this as a Common Core database. So if you're familiar with the charter school movement, you know that part of, you know, what's happened with that data is that you had co-PIs all over the country using completely different research designs and methodologies. So you have one city or state saying, yes, it works. The other one being like, no, it doesn't. And you're like, works how? Like
when it works for what? Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, right? Everyone's using completely different measures. So what we did instead was create a common core of research that goes across all 35 sites where we're working, in addition to some of our colleagues who are not formally partnered with, but we're sharing the same methodology. So at the end of the day, roughly about a year and a half, 2 years from now, you know, our database we'll actually be able to get at and say, okay, at this amount of money for this period of time, we can expect to see outcomes on financial well-being. Or for this amount of money over this duration of time with this particular population, we can expect to see changes in psychological and mental health, right? And so we're really kind of not there yet. And part of what our role has been is trying to build the core of the research in such a way that we have that data when it's time to actually pass some larger pieces of legislation. So it's still so early to say. And really this question of works, like, does it work, right? We get asked this a lot. I think that question means something different to politicians and to the public than it does to us as researchers. So when I think about whether or not does it work, I'm simply looking at it in terms of implementation and proof of concept, right? Obviously, I have all my hypotheses about what I think is going to change and how. But when it comes down to work, it's just, can we get this thing to function? And to be honest with you, when we were running the Stockton experiment, we didn't know. I mean, until the day of, we had no idea if the bank transfer was even going to work onto the debit card. And it was one of those holding your breath moments. When these people swipe this debit card, is there going to be $500 on it? Because surprise, surprise, our American system is not set up to give people money, no strings attached. Even getting the architecture to work was difficult.
No, that's a really good point. And that's one of the things that, and I'll give Michael Schrad and the Center for Social Development so much credit on really trying to test with Seed OK. They really tried to test, can we deliver a CSA program using a 529 system to everyone within, to a larger state, a randomized control trials, 2,000 people. But nonetheless, the point was to test that idea and to see if they could do it. And now we have, seven statewide programs. Even when we first started off, I remember Obama was president. And Martha Cantor was the undersecretary of the Department of Education, I believe. They gave us a grant to do CSAs, to test CSAs nationally. And I was actually on one of the research teams that got selected to do it. And they were going to do it through Gear Up programs. And at the time, and they were going to use state Gear Up programs, right? So there's only a select few states that have that are state Gear Up programs. But one of the problems that we found, they allocated $8 million towards the research and towards the program, but we actually never were able to implement it because the states really didn't know how at that time to run a statewide CSA program. We really didn't have those kinds of examples at large. And in writing up, not only just having those examples, but then writing up documentation so that other people could duplicate it, right? And so that took time. And it's a really important part people don't think about. I think even things like baby bonds now are beginning to experience some of these mm-hmm. issues, right? Because they don't really know how to implement them or if they can implement them at scale. So,
yeah, I mean, it's such a great point. And I think it's telling to me that, I was a bit in the financial capability world before working on guaranteed income. And it's interesting that we face in both sides of the research a similar set of problems. And I think that really comes down to, in many cases, not valuing implementation research, right? Is that everybody gets really excited about momentum and such is in the press. And wow, this is really exciting. And the devil is in the details, right? Especially because we know we're living in a time of austerity where, we do have support on both the right and the left for unconditional cash, but the motivation is really different. We don't figure out the architecture, like what are the key ingredients that it's going to take to make these programs actually fly in the real world. What's going to end up happening is we're going to pass them, but underfund them and then kill them because people are going to say that they're ineffective. This is an age-old tactic that happens in politics. It's not unique to the guaranteed income space. This is how U.S. government wars work. And so part of what we're trying to do is to really drill down and say, what are the expectations here? If it's useful, I can tell you a little bit about sort of what we do know about those key ingredients at this point. There's not a ton that we know, but there's a bit. So, the first thing I would say is that we know that while short-term payments, so think 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, or a lump sum payment similar to the Earned Income Tax Credit or the Alaska Dividend Fund, we know that those are phenomenal at alleviating material hardship. But that's really where it stops. And so, you know, that's good, right? We want people to have more funds in their pocket to be able to pay for basic goods. But we know that it really takes a minimum of 6 months of recurring predictable payments to start to see any type of change in financial well-being, for instance, or in anxiety, depression, more of those like stressors, right? So if we think about the logic behind GI, really the logic is driven by, I mean, beyond kind of the no strings attached piece, is really driven by this notion that income volatility, so when your money's going up and down every month, is moving up the income ladder, right? And so if you're a gig worker, if you're an adjunct professor, if you're a student, you know, even if you're somebody who's making six figures a year, if your cash is unpredictable, it shows up in the body, it shows up in your well-being, and most importantly, you're read differently by the market. So the market works on predictability, right? And so if your funds are unpredictable, you're automatically going to be locked out of all sorts of interventions, all sorts of products that are necessary for financial well-being. So the logic is, if we can smooth that income volatility, do we then create space for human agency, for them to, you know, draw a different path for themselves? And what we learned in Stockton specifically, and that's now been repeated in a few other places, is that it really takes several months of payments to calm down scarcity and to calm down the anxiety that comes from, you know, living in a space of scarcity for so long that it impacts your well-being. So I can tell you a whole lot about what unconditional cash does in a year or in 24 months, for instance. But the reality is, we actually don't know yet what happens beyond 2 years. There's a number of experiments, you know, happening around the United States right now that are 3 years in length or 5 years in length. They're still going. And so we know a lot about decision making in these short term pilots, but what that means for people over time, it's still unknown. And we're super excited to see. So, like, for instance, Willie, I'm thinking about, you know, some of these places that have, you know, child development savings accounts, for instance, where my brain goes is, okay, guaranteed income is about income volatility and it's about income inequality. It's not going to fix the wealth gap, right? That's what asset building is for. But what would happen if we had guaranteed income in a place where people had baby bonds or in a place where people had a child development savings account? Now you're talking about short-term gaps and long-term gaps at the same time. So that's really the place where I hope to see the research go next.
And that's kind of where we're at with St. Paul, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have that randomized controlled trial going where they have CSAs, they're getting guaranteed income, and they're also getting a baby bond light type of deposit. So in addition to the regular one, so hopefully this summer we will have some results from that, you know, early results, first year results. But so very excited about that. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that I actually think that we have for so long, and I'm going to say it this way, done income programs, and they have not worked. Just decades and decades and decades. Centuries of doing kind of income programs as in thinking of poverty as an income problem. And this is not to say that it is not a part of it. It's just not the whole of it. It'd be the same thing to do asset programs and not do income programs, right? You're not totally addressing the issue of poverty and the root causes of poverty when you just address one or the other. So I really think policy-wise, that's where we have to go if our goal is to actually alleviate poverty. Because you can take care of the symptoms of poverty, right? Which is relevant and important and necessary. If you had a cold, you really want that drug that gets rid of that immediate, you know, stuffy nose or whatever else. But you also have to take care of the kind of the long-term problem of becoming a kind of fissure or financially capable is what I would really say, but a kind of like a fisher yourself, not just someone giving you fish. And that's really where assets come in, is they allow you to begin. You need to be able to build assets in a capitalist society. We can change our system, but until we do, you have to be able to build wealth, and low income people have to build wealth. It's also a problem if we just give them a large sum of money and we haven't taught them. So what I'm also saying, and I'll be quiet, is we also need to bring in the financial capability piece of this, the financial literacy piece of this, not the financial capability. Financial capability is a component of all of those things. But financial literacy also is important. It's giving them money so they can make it day to day, helping them build assets, but then also providing them with some financial knowledge so that they can really be financially capable on their own.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the logic there. I haven't seen any data yet on it, right? So I will say I don't know of any guaranteed income program in the United States that is empirically rigorous. It might be out there. I just don't know about it. There's a lot of momentum right now that is providing unconditional cash in a recurring manner that's also providing financial capability. It was sort of in the parlance of guaranteed income, the guaranteed income space, we would call that cash plus. So cash as an intervention on one hand, plus something else. I draw a pretty hard line between financial capability and financial literacy. I mean, mostly because the research on financial literacy is pretty
good.
We have a meta-analysis from 2015 that shows that 0.1% of financial behaviors can be attributed to financial literacy programs. Mm-hmm. That's it. But yeah. Meanwhile, we've dumped millions and millions and millions of dollars into these programs. Interestingly, without ever testing them. I mean, it's interesting because when you look at the research on it, you see a lot of satisfaction surveys. And I'm like, well, I don't want to know if it's satisfaction. I want to know, are these people able to have more savings? And I think one of the key failures of those programs has been, you know, you can educate somebody in the market all you want, but at the end of the day, you can't rearrange $15,000 a year to make yourself live. You just can't. Right? So we don't know yet, I think. I would love to see a program that is actually really clear about what they're teaching on financial capability, while also at the same time, in a really rigorous way, providing recurring cash. That would be, I think, a really brilliant program. I don't know of any yet, so if someone does, send it my way. But I wonder, what's that?
So I have to respond on this to some degree. Yeah. So let me clarify a few things.
Yeah.
One thing is, when I talk about financial capability, I'm not even talking about it in the Margaret Sheridan, Lisa Johnson, where they added the institutional piece of it. So they said beyond just financial knowledge, you also had to have inclusion, which is access to institutions, which made sense because it's within kind of institutional theory framework. I'm also saying that you need resources to be financially capable. And I would define resources as income and assets, right? So you actually have to have for this knowledge to be experiential and for you to use it in ways that you can remember and all those kind of things. It has to be tied to not only institutional access, but then also actually having a guaranteed income or something of that nature and having assets to go along with it. To me, that's when you become financially capable. I totally agree with you on your read of kind of the financial literacy literature, right? I mean, that's, to me, that is the case, is that there's very, in evidence that there is, even when it's randomized control trial, the results tend to flee after a short period of time, right? So I have seen examples where there are results that are positive, but after a few years, those they tend to fade and go away.
That stickiness just doesn't last. Yeah, and that's one of the things. I mean, my goodness, like, to me, this is one of the most vexing questions around economic mobility research in general. Be that guaranteed income or asset building, or, you know, choose the intervention. Is that, you know, I want to know how long do these changes hold up? Like, what are we doing if we're only providing people with funding for a finite period of time? What can we expect to see as a catalyst, and what else is happening in that space? And I think oftentimes we don't have the discipline, or the focus many times to sort of stick around long enough to see what happens. I mean, one of the things that we've been doing in our projects is where we're able to, getting agreements in place for administrative data collection. Reason being, we want to be able to see 10 years from now, can I go back in time through administrative data and see the people who received an unconditional cash transfer, you know, over a given period of time, were they less likely to go to the ER? Did they have, you know, differences in terms of, you know, public benefits utilization? Those are questions we can actually get at if we're clever in the way that we design these things. But I also just wanted to return real quick to something you said a few minutes ago, which is thinking about these root causes of poverty, right? Because I think that you're touching on something really, really important, is that we often think about things almost in this flat way of how do we provide assets, or how do we provide cash, or how do we provide the ideal program? But we forget to address what happens to the body and the mind when you are living underneath the weight of chronic scarcity for generations. And so much of this has to do with deservedness, is that, you know, every single thing in the market and in the economy and in community is telling low-income people that they don't matter. You know, every message that they're receiving implicitly. And what that does to somebody over time is they internalize it, you know, to the point that even when the perfect intervention comes along, people may not engage with it if A, they don't trust the government or the program, and B, they're so beat down by capitalism that they cannot see a path forward. And so this is why I think we have, you know, an obligation in many cases, I mean, those of us who study economic research in this way, to say, in addition to the intervention, how do we study the way that people make sense of the world so that when and if we are able to pass smart evidence-based policy on cash, that end user is willing to take a risk and jump into that program? Because again, I said this before, you know, part of this problem is that we underfund programs or we design them to fail on, you know, on the policy side, and then we underinvest in them, and that becomes a logic to pull them away. And so one of our key jobs here is really figuring out, what are these messages? How are they internalized, and how are they blocking people from being able to set an alternative path? You know, it's really, I think, a vexing question.
I think this is one place in which the asset field, not because of anything it did, only because of when it started in Stratton in 1991. So we now have kids who we're doing research on, we will have data on this summer again, that have been in these programs for 18 years now and going to college.
So exciting.
Right? I mean, it's really exciting. It's scary.
Oh, exciting.
Because it's the moment, right? Which doesn't increase college enrollment, right? I mean, we're going to know here relatively soon.
Just blame it on FAFSA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But also, I will say that I probably have a slightly different view. So I've worked a lot with behavioral economists over the years, and I've seen a lot of, to be honest, I think a lot of times they just, I don't know. Anyhow, I won't get into that. But nevertheless.
I think I know where you were going with that.
Yeah. It's, I don't know about the messaging. I do think this is where Sherrod and institutional theory come into place. And I'm also taking some of this from my own life experience, having, because I was homeless and blah, blah, blah for so many years. And even now, I was talking in the last episode, is even after I'm 54, and I make good money, and I have some assets now, and all these things, there's a part of me that will be always be poor. My kids don't experience this at all. That affects my thinking, and that I'll never get rid of it. That's why I understand that some financial knowledge and learning is useful. It doesn't make me less. It's just that I've ingrained so many things over years that you have to do some of those things. But my point is to say that what we learn in asset theory is it's much better to enroll everybody automatically than it is to try to figure out ways to get, because if you're, it starts with having changed experiences. So if I put you in the institution and I get the money and my day-to-day changes, then I start to trust you. We want them to trust us from the beginning. Over time, I think that will happen. As more people enroll in it, they get more communications with other, and there's this goodwill that goes on, then you can do that. But it's hard to start from the beginning and say, hey, trust me. You have to let them experience the institution and how it benefits their life, and then they convey that to others, and they don't have to go through that same process, right?
Yeah, no, I feel you. It's funny what you just said. You're like, just trust me. I mean, there's 100 stories I could tell you about trying to get Stockton off the ground, but that was probably one of the ones that was the most difficult, along with the ethical issues it introduced. But, you know, now I say, I put guaranteed income into Google News search, and however many thousands of stories are popping up, and there's programs all over the United States. I mean, it's extraordinary, the amount of momentum. But when we first started, people did not know what we were talking about. We spent weeks and weeks and weeks all over Stockton, just talking to anyone and everyone we possibly could, and working really closely with Mayor Tubbs to try and break down that trust barrier. And, you know, one of the things that was really interesting, I mean, the level at which we had to sort of do community engagement will never be lost on me. But one of the things that was interesting is that it really took about 3 to 4 months of payments for people to continue to believe the money was going to be there every month. And I really thought, really probably naively, that as more experimentation took place and we moved more across the country and we had kind of saturated public discourse, you know, with the child tax credit, CARES Act stimulus payments, like we were experimenting with cash all over the place during the pandemic, that trust piece would start to become less salient or would happen faster. I was completely wrong. We are still in the middle of launching projects in our center because there's a lot of things we don't know about particular populations. And that time duration has held. which has been really, really interesting.
Let me say something about that. I don't find it as interesting, only because I would say that while in the public discourse, a lot of people know about it, right? In those individual communities, they're not paying as much attention to all that stuff outside, not in a concrete way. They hear something about it, but it's something out there. And so I think you're saying the same thing in some ways is it until they experience, I think when you said about the three payments is really useful, right? Like that idea that like it's through those experiences that they actually can challenge we're people who have been like, that's poor 26, 27 years of just ravaged devastation of poverty. Like, you don't just shake that off.
No. No, it doesn't go away. Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. Even though they might become quite trustworthy as they get these payments of guaranteed income payments and that, it doesn't mean when you bring the next thing in that's different from that, that they'll just jump to that right away. My point is because you just build up all this distrust in a way that hinders you to be successful financially and otherwise, you have to almost establish that in each area again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's, I think what we keep dancing around without saying it, know is that poverty is traumatizing and it permanently alters the way that you see the world and your way of being. I mean, you know, I had my own personal experiences, you know, with poverty, with safety net. I mean, the last year I was on public benefits was 2014. That's not that long ago, right? And to this day, I mean, I'm financially secure. I have nothing to worry about. I mean, I have the very rare experience of being tenured and know that I have a job for life. I do. You know, I mean, that's just my reality. And even still, when I open up my refrigerator at the end of the week, when it's like about time for my wife to go to the grocery shopping next, I get it in my gut because the fridge looks thinner. Even though I can open up my phone and I can look in my bank account and immediately see what are my assets, how much money do I, and sometimes I do that. Like I'll own that. Like there are still days where me as a tenured professor at an Ivy League school, I look at, you know, my kids' college bills coming in and I'm like, let me just look at my bank account one more time, right? Because I'm scarred in some way by poverty. And what I've experienced is nothing compared to a whole bunch of other folks. And so I think what I'm getting at is on the one hand, you know, we need to design smart evidence-based things that create more efficiency in the system. We need that, right? There's a lot of bloat, administrative burdens, you know, in addition to like wasting money, they cause a lot of problems for people. But one of the things that we also need to think about in implementation science around this issue is the secret sauce of human interaction, right? So the way that I like to think about it is, you know, human contact right now in the United States is a luxury good. If you're poor, if you are experiencing poverty, if you're low income, you actually have less meaningful human interactions when you're dealing with any institutions than those of us who have higher economic means, right? It's like you're experiencing poverty. What do you get? You get talk space, right? You want to text with somebody, you know, do you think the rich, the uber wealthy are sitting there doing talk space? No, hell no. They are sitting there with a very expensive therapist. And I'm sure that they're all on Esther Perel's waiting list, right? We think about human contact is this luxury good. We think about the waiting lines when it comes to things like SNAP benefits and Section 8, and you're calling and you're calling and you're calling, and you don't get a human being on the other line. You know, one of the secrets of guaranteed income is that even though the program or the intervention itself is simple, it's literally just cash, it also comes with human interaction, because in these places where we're working, people know that when they pick up the phone, they're going to get a human being on the other line. And that literal piece of connection tells people that they matter in some way. This is actually something that we measure and we follow in our experiments. And I think it's really crucial, because in this rush around implementation data, which is obviously really important, one of the things, key ingredients that we need to put into that equation is, okay, not just how much money does it take to run one of these programs over what period of time, but what's the human labor, right? How many social workers does it take to run a guaranteed income program? And we have the luxury, we're only going to have this luxury for a short period of time, but we have the luxury right now as social welfare scientists to be able to cook that in from the very beginning and say, here's a key ingredient. So we don't have to claw for it later, right? Is to say, this isn't just about efficiency, but for every, you know, I'm making this up right now, we don't actually have this data yet, but you know, for every dollar that's spent on guaranteed income disbursements, you need to have X number of hours in human interaction. And I'm not saying for therapy, that's not what I mean, but I'm talking about actual human beings that make these programs run. And that counterweight of connection is the secret sauce of building trust. I mean, it really is. Like you, poverty does something to us. We know it alters the brain structure. That research has been, you know, pretty well established in neuroscience at this point for well over 10 years. But we still feel these impacts in the way that we see the world. And I think you're right. They don't go away. They're there under the surface.
I know even today when I go to the ATM or if I go check out, I'm always worried. I mean, I know there's money in the account, but I'm always, and if there's an error or something, I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, you're like, run away.
Yeah, I'm not angry at the teller or I'm like fearful that somehow my money's gone, right? You know what I mean? I don't know. It's a different kind of feeling. But I'm 54, I've had all this time, blah, blah, blah. And I'm still like, I mentioned last week, I went to buy, you know, I buy a car now, I trade it in, they give me money for my car because I don't owe on it. I'm not upside down. Mm-hmm. Like some of those like experiences, I knew that those were realities in for people. But they were real to me. Like they didn't. Like now, I'm like, I tell my kids about it. I'm like, dude, you're like, you're gonna be able to, you know, trade your car, and I already, you know, we got you a car, and you can trade this thing in, and it'll be. Poor people don't even know that they don't know that. Like they know it, but they don't really know what that means and how that advantages them. Right? Because I didn't own so many different things. And so my point is to say, this is why I think financial literacy, even though by itself is not good, and it certainly has to be shaped a certain way, is an important element of this because we just have had all this trauma and don't know and understand the advantages that all these other people have. And I'm talking about very basic things. I'm not talking about understanding a home loan and all the details of it. None of us know that, right? Unless you're a financial manager. But I'm just talking about some basic things that really would help them. So it's not just about a baby bond and giving them money at the end of the day. Here's a pot of money when you graduate and go do great things with it. A, it's not enough money. Even if I give you $80,000, you've had a pot of money. It goes by very fast if you don't use it very, you know. So. Yeah, and it's not about criticizing them as like they're bad people. It's just they've been disadvantaged for so long that it also affects their ability to know everything they need to know, the way they need to know it, so they can make all the good decisions. That doesn't mean take all the power away from them, still want to empower them. It's a very tricky conversation, right? Because then people just trigger it as, well, you just don't think poor people can do anything and they're not smart and they can manage money. Yeah, I can manage money as a poor person. It's very different managing it as a person with money. It's a different thing because I'm managing on how I'm going to make these Twinkies last for 3 days and, you know what I mean, stuff like that. Where now I'm saying, ooh, I should trade my car in and get the money back out of it, you know what I mean? And maybe I won't even have a car payment because I can put, you know, it's a very different kind of management. Both important.
But one of the things that came through so clearly, Dr. Kester, in the guaranteed income research was this idea that people are experts in their own lives, mm-hmm. And that what they need are the tools with which they can pursue whatever it is that they see as their truth and their kind of North Star, their hope. And really that to me aligns with what you said early and frequently to folks when we were talking about children's savings accounts and people were all worried about what are we going to do to make sure parents aren't going to take this money
steal it from their own children.
right, reminding people that the one truth we know is that parents want good things for their kids.
Yeah.
And so both of those like kind of core assumptions, sure, there's lots of stuff to test. And I noted the places where the guaranteed income is looking at those social effects that hope as an outcome. Where are we seeing hope actually in people's lives? What does that look like? Just like, Willie's looking at, okay, what are, expectations? Like, there are clearly things to test there, but there's also an ideology, a core belief in both strains of economic empowerment research that says, like, people have what they need, except all of the stuff they need. They know what they need. They need the tools. I guess my last question that I would love to hear folks talk about is, to me, it is so encouraging to see people who are leading in these complementary spheres around helping families with their economic lives think in so many of the same ways about what people should have and where we have failed, and how your respective areas of work complement rather than contradict or compete with each other. I guess what needs to happen now for these strands to weave together in some ways? I know, we know it is happening some in St. Paul. We had Mayor Carter come and talk with us about that. But like on a bigger level and in other places in the country, what needs to happen for these to knit together here?
Ooh, I mean, there's so many things. I should also say, I think I should have mentioned this prior and I didn't, but the idea of unconditional cash has a really long history in the United States. I mean, Thomas Paine wrote about the birth of our democracy. It was part of Dr. King's last book. I mean, I'm not here at this moment because I had a really good idea in 2018, right? Is that like, no, like this momentum that's happening right now, I mean, from the outside, it looks like it kind of came out of nowhere, but in reality, it wouldn't exist without political philosophers, organizers, advocates, thinkers, working on this issue for literally well over 100 years, thinking about this. We're thinking about unconditional cash, but then at the same time, the asset building space within social welfare and social work really laid the policy architecture for our current political moment. I mean, I am flat out convinced, I think it's a number of strands, but I am flat out convinced that we would not be where we are right now with guaranteed income in the United States if Sheridan and company hadn't laid those lines down in the early 90s. We just wouldn't be, right? I almost think of it, in policy research, we call it softening the ground, is that you ask this question, how do you soften the ground? So we know, like on the one hand, you need consensus in the empirical literature to build out evidence-based policy, but you also need consensus in public discourse, and that requires softening the ground. And so, I mean, to me, I have been this enormous beneficiary, along with all the people who are participating in these experiments, whether they pan out or not in terms of the hypotheses. That's not the point. We know that poverty by definition is lack of cash. Ergo, we give people cash, they're not as poor anymore. This is not rocket science, right? Like this is not rocket science, right? But when I look at the ways that these things dovetail, there's all kinds of things I could say about hypotheses, but I'm a big fan of understanding context. And I think the reality is the U.S. has been really late to the game on unconditional cash. We have our colleagues all over the world and every type of income brackets, community and country you could think of that have been trying this forever. But really what we have in the United States is a much longer history on financial capability and asset building. That's really ours. And so, to me, I look at this as the asset building researchers that came, way before any of this stuff was existing at scale. One, they were laying an evidence-based framework, but two, they were really softening the ground politically so that we could have this moment where, Dr. Elliott's in this position where he's like, hey, look, I've been studying asset building forever, and now I get to study unconditional cash alongside that, right? I mean, that's incredible. And so to me, there's 100 things I could say about hypotheses moving forward. But I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to us having an open hand and being willing to take risks and say, now that I've built up this giant thing, right? I have a whole center labeled guaranteed income, right? My challenge, as a PI is to not hold on to that so tightly that I'm unwilling to say, what's the next way that I need to think about this in light of, who knows what these findings will show this summer when these children, we have data on these children who've been in an experiment for 18 years. Like, that's pretty exciting. And that takes discipline and humility to be able to say, I know what I know, but I don't know what I don't know. And really curious about it. So maybe a longer answer than you were looking for.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. Really important.
I think I'm glad you mentioned that too, because I will say in addition to that, so I think you're right. I think the asset piece really has laid way for this. But in addition to that, I really think it is COVID. It's the Great Depression. It's killing of Black people, right? All these things have created a moment where people want change. They want something different. And so, like you said, conditional cash transfer has been around for however long. It couldn't take root because we didn't have the conditions for it to happen, both politically, narratively, and then also just from the economic shocks that we've experienced that have really brought into question kind of the system as it is. And so I think it's helped with baby bonds and everything else. People are like, well, it's flat out. Well, it's because of all this stuff. I mean, I can remember going to D.C. Remember, you went with me on some occasions when, you know, they talking about something like free college or other, which really just at this infancy stage, right? I say I give free college a lot of credit as well because it was so big, right? So, oh, we can talk in public spaces about an idea that is really transformational. Like, we couldn't do that 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, people are demanding more. They should be, right? I mean, this drives me crazy. I'm sitting there, I'm like, we have this givenness about the social contract and this givenness about the economy. Budgets are moral documents. The social contract is a construction. We do not have to live with things the way that they are. We have an opportunity to change things and push back on it. And I think you're totally right, you know, to point this out is that people have kind of said, I mean, people are working more and making less. Like, I won't belabor the stats on a podcast. Anybody can find that for themselves or just look at their own life and calendar, right? Is that like people are drowning. And when we look at, you know, the long tail of the Great Recession, we know that most working class households have not recovered. You know, same thing is true post pandemic. I mean, I can't even with inflation being used as a cover, right? Is that people are demanding more. You know, I'll give one teaser. This is, we've presented this publicly, although it's not in publication yet. It's under review, but it's been presented at several conferences. So I feel confident I can say this publicly. One of the things that we did in these experiments, almost like last minute as a whim, you know, we obviously were collecting baseline data because most of these studies that we're running are RCTs. So in Stockton, we embedded some questions in the baseline survey, asking people what we thought others would do with the money. So drawing a page from Saccombe, you know, if you're familiar with the article, they think nothing much of us, which is these ideas that we have about people in welfare. And people who are experiencing poverty will often assume the best of themselves and the worst of everybody else. This has been pretty established in the social welfare literature for well over 25 years. And we thought, you know, I'm looking at the world. We just had all this, you know, social unrest post-recession, you know, for all of the reasons. You know, now we have Black Lives Matter and we have other places, you know, obviously college protest and just in general, we're living through a time of unrest. We just had this instinct, something feels like it's changing in the public discourse. Not sure what, but why not see? So we asked these questions at baseline in Stockton. And what was really interesting was that contrary to all of the other social welfare literature on assuming a lack of rationality or assuming irrational behavior or assuming poor spending or poor attitudes on behalf of everybody around them. When people were filling out that baseline survey, and we also did some interviews on this as well, they would assume the best of people, not the worst. What was interesting was they presumed roughly four things. So one, they presumed that there was a collective experience of financial stress, which is really interesting to me because I've been studying poverty for a really long time, both as a social worker and as a researcher. And until really the recession, people would internalize poverty or they would internalize financial stress and be like, I must have failed. I did something wrong. I did something wrong. I did something wrong. And we saw a flip in our data. And, you know, we also repeated this exact same method across the first eight studies that we worked with in the Guaranteed Income Study, American Guaranteed Income Studies, which we're publishing right now. And people presumed a collective experience of financial stress. There was an assumption that the financial stress that I'm experiencing, my neighbors are experiencing, which is really interesting. Second, people presumed that any spending on children was automatically deserving, which I think is pretty telling when we think about the fact that the child tax credit was canned and we're talking about things like baby bonds. I think that offers us a pathway forward. So second, people presumed any spending on kids is automatically deserving. But then third, most interestingly, was people were very resistant to ascribe morality to others. So they would say, I don't know, if somebody's going to spend this money a particular way, they must need it for their kids. That's really, really different than anything that we've seen before in the press. And by the way, that happened, we measured that for the first time 2018 or in early 2019, pre-pandemic, then asked the same questions again in the middle of the experiment, at the end of the experiment, and then have repeated it in all these different places across the United States, the South, the Midwest, rural areas, urban areas. And it's really kind of hell. There's pockets of people who are like, well, no, you know, so-and-so is, you know, must be lazy, or these tropes and myths of the welfare queen definitely get trotted out, but not in any way to the degree that we thought we were going to see. And so I think we are at a tipping point. We're living through a point in U.S. history and really global history where, you know, we think about technology and AI, that's one part of this, but really it's about rethinking what era we're in. You know, so I don't know what each of your universities requires students to teach, but at Penn, our students are all required to read, you know, A Brief History of Neoliberalism by David Harvey. And I keep joking to my students, like, this book is relevant, but also I don't have language yet for what we're living through right now. Because it's not exactly neoliberalism, and it's not exactly late capitalism. So I'm like, just keep your eyes out, guys. Someone's going to write a book, A Brief History of Blank, at some point in the next 15 years, and we'll have it on the syllabi. But my point being, we're living through this dramatic time of change, which I think is really exciting, because what we're able to do is interrogate some of these structures. And by the way, if we don't dismantle the myth of the welfare queen, all we're going to do is migrate it off of TANF and onto asset building and onto guaranteed income and unconditional cash. Like, we just move these tropes from one thing to the other, and then they categorize people as being undeserving. So we've got work to do, but I also think that we're up for it. I think that we're in a moment of reckoning. And I mean, I never thought that we would be running guaranteed income experiments more than once. I mean, we designed that RCT with all these different arms and data collection methods because we thought it was our one shot. And, you know, that was really a failure of our imagination and a failure of our ability to trust our colleagues and trust the American people who have really said, like, no, I'm good. Like, enough of this. Like, why are we living this way? Like, there's like, why? Kind of like toddlers is the way they think about it, right? You know, it's like, we don't have to, you know, kids will ask, they're like, what? Well, why is that? What color is that tree? It's green. Well, why is it green? I don't know, chlorophyll. What's chlorophyll? You explain why is it called that, right? Like, we need to have the same level of curiosity and imagination, interrogation about the way that things are. But for some reason, we lose that sense of wonder as we get older.
I totally agree with all that. And that's really good stuff. You did bring me back. I mean, Melinda, if you remember, a lot of the things we were writing early on was about trying to get people to hope. Because I think that was one of the biggest problems when you went to DC, is they were fighting for the status quo constantly. Yes. Gosh. We can do more than this. And they couldn't see anything more, not just in DC, but everywhere. And so it's good to see that in your data, we're starting to see that shift and change. It's awesome.
Are you all, I'm going to flip it back. I got to know, are you two experiencing a shift in your respective areas as well? Do you sense that there's something that's changing?
I would say, go ahead, Melinda.
Well, no, I mean, I just think that there are a lot of shifts. I think that's something that folks who are doing children's asset work need to contend with, is the extent to which the dreams people have for their kids have changed. Not the idea that I want something wonderful for my kid. That's the same. But whether that wonderful state travels at all through higher education and what people are thinking about college and the role that it plays in their own lives and their communities and our society, that has changed really more than at least I foresaw 20 years ago. And I think that a lot of programs and really policy directions in children's asset spaces are going to have to think somewhat differently about the structures that families are going to want to leverage to try to pursue the good life for their kids. That's moved a lot more than I certainly anticipated.
That will also say that it's exciting and scary, because I don't think that it's changed for all the right reasons sometimes. I think that there is, like if you read the data, they say that Republican men now aren't going to college because they see it as a liberal endeavor. That's just bad for everybody.
Yes, right? It's bad for everyone. We need an educated workforce.
Right, we do, right? And so
in society and
election. I'm not saying everybody should go to college and college, right? But just this blanket idea that it's like un-American to go to college, well, that's problematic, right? But beyond that, I also want to say that, like, if you knew me well, you know I'm like a half-full person. Like, my cup is always half-full. But I will say on this note, as much as we see all this exciting change and that we're at this kind of moment, that I think you're absolutely right, I think it could swing either way. Because I think that there's people who want to see the system change for the better, and there are people who just want it to be overthrown because they see it as absolutely evil, and for very different reasons. Even when you talk about, earlier on, you talked about, and I think we see the same thing in the CSA world, is that you talked about how some people want unconditional cash transfers, but for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right? It's the same thing about CSAs. They have been proposed as replacements for any number of services, whether it be the Social Security system or whatever else, right? And so yeah, and it's very exciting, but man, we need to win. Because if we don't win, we're going to go into a populace or something, you know, something really destructive really bad place. So I think these are extremely important times that we live in. Mm-hmm. And there's so much at balance. There's so much opportunity because so much is at balance. But then also, if we don't win, I think our kids will have a very different world to live in. And I'm not saying that to be, you know, hyperbole. I think
it's reality. It's reality. We can't continue on this path and expect things to just somehow pop back. We just cannot. That might be for another day to interrogate why.
And people can't live in chaos forever.
No.
I study self-efficacy. Like at age 4, you start developing self-efficacy. But you know, that's when you're questioning your I can do belief.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. And, you know, Bandura talks about, you know, people who are high, but you can't constantly be asking that question. You have to kind of live in an outcome space most of the time.
Yeah.
And society is the same way. We could talk forever. This has been awesome.
I know. I wish we could have you come back next weekend. I'm joking. We're not going to. But I loved hearing you talk. And truly, the way that you're pursuing your work, the questions that you're asking, and the extent to which the folks who are participating in these programs are so clearly center for your reason why you're engaging in the research and your insistence on the way that you design and then pursue that. I just am really just impressed and appreciative and of the work that you're doing and your willingness.
Let me close this out today instead of Melinda. It's also been very useful for me as an asset researcher. I think of poverty and all those things. But you're in the guaranteed income space. Mm-hmm. And these can be seen as two different spaces and are often thought about as two different spaces. But having had the chance to talk to you for the first time in real depth, and I really thought about bringing you on so that these spaces could be brought together more, right?
Yeah.
And this is kind of like what I was talking about as being a poor person who gets money, and then all of a sudden you're like, things become more clear to you. It's become more clear to me how connected and how close our ideas are and the things we're experiencing, we're learning. Right? But that wasn't as real to me an hour ago as it is now. So I appreciate that. And that will only motivate and help me think more clearly and be more passionate about bringing these two groups together and some other groups as well. So we're going to end there and say, please like and subscribe because it helps everybody, helps the algorithm. I'm supposed to say something like that. And
just helps people find you, really. Yeah.
All right. So we're going to stop there. Thanks, everyone.